Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. This is broadcast number 714, August 12, 1985, and the name of this program is World Watchers. It's a one-hour analysis of news events, the horror stories of the week, and if cassettes are available of this broadcast, if you've missed any in the past or want any of the past programs, you can write to me, Mae Brussel, P.O. Box 22511, Carmel, California. I better put that at the beginning of the show because as I get towards the end, I get in a hurry and I always forget to tell you these tapes are available. Now, it's impossible the way the news is falling these days to share with you in 1 hour all of the stories or even to explain their links to past events that I've been detailing for the past 14 years. But David Emery and Nip Tuck from KFJC in the Bay Area, from Los Altos Hills, have several programs that are very worthwhile. One is a weekly program on Sunday evenings, and then they take calls from their listening audience. But they also have a series that is becoming very valuable and should belong to anybody's collection with of tape cassettes of the current history of the United States. And this background material is wonderful to put together the names that I'm throwing out for old listeners and the new listeners may not know. This is a very valuable experience. They have broadcasts on the background of political assassinations, on Vietnam and Watergate, the Nazi connections to the Kennedy assassination, the hidden history of the Cold War, the two-part series on that, Reinhard Gehlen and his organization, Turple, Wilson and Company. They've titled that broadcast. That is really terror on the right, blaming the left, how the counterintelligence corps brings down the violence so they have an excuse, the military defense system, to move in and take action. There are several broadcasts on Operation Mind Control. This is a three-part program they did, and the third part is on the cults. And they have a broadcast with Joe Holsinger and the Jonestown Massacre, another series of tapes on assassination of Martin Luther King, three 90-minute tapes on Robert Kennedy, two 90-minute tapes on the Aryan Nations, one broadcast on AIDS, is it epidemic or conspiracy, and another on the KKK and the founding of the Nazi Party. Very good work. Another on Uncle Sam and the swastika. These are very valuable broadcasts, and as I say, this is the background material, and they cite book after book so that you know as a starter where to look for information to explain what is coming down today. And then once you obtain the books that they mentioned, which are available to buy at bookstores, preferably from Tom Davis Research in Capitola, who carries these books, most of them, then look in the back and get the references that that author uses for other books, and then you're on your way to becoming a researcher like us. I am going to continue on Simon Wiesenthal and the deal he made in São Paulo, Brazil, next week. I promised to do it this week, but I'm a promise breaker, and there's just too much news moving along too swiftly that I want to get into quickly, but it's very important, and I want to share it with you. One is the Justice Department appointment that will be coming as soon as Congress gets back in September. This is the middle of August, so we're speaking about 2 or 3 weeks from now. Edwin Meese, the Attorney General, has appointed his long friend from California, who worked with Ronald Reagan in California, Herbert E. Ellingwood, to head the Justice Department Office of Legal Policy. In this way, he'll screen every candidate for federal judges. He's ready to help Ronald Reagan select 114 federal judges, more than one-seventh of the judiciary, and he also will have his say on who is appointed on the Supreme Court, because that is inevitable. Justice Powell is ill, and pretty soon, when Congress gets back together, you'll see an appointment on the Supreme Court. Now, Ellingwood's name appeared at a time when Meese was under investigation. Of course, they were all cleared. He got a woman, Mrs. Thomas, and Mr. Thomas, the two of them, jobs out in California when right after they gave a $15,000 loan to Edwin Meese in 1980. Gretchen Thomas got a job at the Merit Board out in California. And Mr. Ellingwood is out there also. He is a member of the Christian Broadcasting. He's on the board of the Christian Broadcasting Network University. He holds prayer meetings in his office. He speaks to Christian groups. But he also sent out brochures recommending that civil service jobs be given to Christians. The General Accounting Office found last year that he earned $16,000 speaking to Christian groups. He made this on his own, using time from the government, of course, to talk to Christian groups, traveling around while he's working for the General Accounting Office, and encouraging them to get into, of course, government policies and government jobs. While Reagan was governor of California, he allegedly prayed for him. Reagan was supposed to have had ulcers. I hear he had something different than that in Sacramento, but he prayed for him, and it was a miracle. The Sacramento Bee described that, and now he is working to stop abortions, and he thinks Christians should be involved in politics. And Ellingwood provided help to a Christian talent bank operated by the American Coalition for Traditional Values, a network of 100,000 fundamentalist Christians, when he has an important job at the present time and now wants to move into the Office of Legal Policy. He's with the Merit Systems Protection Board and is going to move on to this other job if that is allowed. Now, Reverend Moon's paper, The Washington Times, talks about the controversy that's going to heat up and how groups are going to try to stop his being appointed. But the quotation here is, "Our nation has overwhelmingly elected a president who made no attempt to hide his well-publicized commitment to traditional values." The president may be traditional, but this is not a Christian nation, even though they're trying to say, and that controversy has been heating up, that this is a Christian nation. Wall Street Journal, an article August the 8th, just last week, "Conservatives have their own brand of judicial activism." This is an article by Michael Kinsley, K-I-N-S-L-E-Y, and he says, "Attorney General Edwin Meese said in January that a key goal of the second Reagan administration would be to institutionalize the Reagan Revolution so it can't be set aside no matter what happens in future presidential elections." That is the way he wants it. That's what happened when he was nominated. The people that didn't want abortions were behind him. The others didn't vote, and that's what we're left with. The Wall Street Journal also has a story, "New Right Group Promotes Reagan Ideology in State Capitals from Boise to Baton Rouge." This is August the 7th, Wall Street Journal. And it tells how an organization with the initials ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, is moving away from Capitol Hill into 50 state capitals to see how the new right is doing in state capitals. They will influence people. It will be a clearinghouse for conservatives. It will target state legislators and identify those who aren't Christian or right, I suppose, and it will watch the agenda and try to influence and organize and get into the individual 50 state capitals. Their objective is conservative control, either through an outright GOP majority or a coalition of Republicans and conservative Democrats. So they're going state by state, and this article in the Wall Street Journal says how they started small with $10,000 and a staff of 20. They now have $1.5 million and a staff of 2,000. But given the 100,000 members of the church group that Mr. Ellingwood is a part of, they will get the money, and besides that, the CIA can funnel the money to them, and you wouldn't know where it was coming, and I wouldn't either. So in order to set this country on a course that it is obviously headed towards, this is just one more organization tying in to Mr. Ellingwood and the intent to change the face of this nation. Almost every story or article I read goes back to those persons responsible for murdering John Kennedy or for covering up John Kennedy, and therefore that investigation is always the one that's closest to my mind, and details of that assassination keep appearing all the time. A matter came up on KFJC just last week, and I do want to take time to speak about that because it is important to always clarify where my opinion is on certain material that is coming out on the Kennedy assassination when my name is used and misquoted. A person by the name of Roger called KFJC last week. I know Roger. I've known him about 10 years. He spoke with Nip Tuck and David Emery, and he was talking about David Lifton's book, Best Evidence. And Roger claimed that he had talked to Mae Brussel on the telephone and that she passed off the book with two words, like no good or something to the effect, just passed it off out of hand was his term. that I didn't pay much attention to the book and that he had called me several years ago about it. He didn't say when on the air, but I haven't talked to him in 2 years. And that I just passed off the book, and that he thought it was a very important book in regards to Kennedy assassination. So I thought for the listeners at KFJC or others who haven't read the book and who've heard about it, I would just repeat some of the comments I made. I did an entire broadcast on Best Evidence in March, that's 1981, March 22nd, tape number 485, and that tape is available for anybody who wants it. Now, first of all, anybody who knows me knows that my problem is talking on the telephone so much. I could write 10 books in the time I talk on the phone. And if anybody calls me and asks me about a particular book or anything on the Kennedy assassination, I'll talk as long as they have money to put in the telephone bill, because that subject I like to talk about, and I've never passed any book on it about any research by any researcher, pardon me, on the Kennedy assassination in just two words, sloughed it off or passed it off. Now, as regards this book written by David Lifton, I really look forward to the book. I knew David had been writing a book on the Kennedy assassination. He's writing another one right now. I'd known David Lifton since we each had a part in writing that original Rand Parts article on the John F. Kennedy assassination. We had worked on that case, and I'd been working the Kennedy case since 1963. I don't remember when I met David Lifton, but it had to do with the Ramparts article at that time. After that, we became friends, and we corresponded, talked on the phone. As a matter of fact, he did me a favor that no other single researcher has done since before. He was working in the National Archives back east in Washington. I've never been able to get there. He was working on various documents he knew that I would want or could use pertaining to Lee and Marina Oswald as possible agents of the federal government, and he copied documents for me on the JFK case. Some I've seen in books or in print magazines, but some have never been used or seen and were obviously not available later, so they were probably sloughed off or skimmed out. So I appreciated his researching the case. Besides that, he wrote document addendum on the Warren Commission, the meetings of the Warren Commission members, which is one of the most valuable books that any researcher has done. It's number one or two right up there with the others because it shows the intent of the commission right from the day they started. So we had worked together. He had helped me. He was a friend. And there was no reason why I wouldn't want to look forward to the book of David Lifton. Now, when the book came out, I got a call from an editor, the editor from We Magazine, and he wanted me to do a review of the book. He said, to paraphrase his words, you're one of the best researchers in the country. We want your opinion of this book, and you have 3 months to do it. Write a book review, approximately 12 pages, double-spaced, and they would pay me $750 for the review. It's the only book review I've ever gotten that kind of money for. So I had no axe to grind with Lifton. I liked him. I was indebted to him. And this would be an easy assignment for me. So I spent 3 months reading Best Evidence. I read it, I reread it, and I outlined it. And I might mention that maybe Nip Tuck felt it was valuable. He's doing the program with David Emery up there. Maybe sometime he would share with me what he learned from it or what anybody else has learned from it, and then maybe I could know. But for Nip or Roger, I just tell you that I spent 3 months on it, put everything else aside. I went through each of the allegations of the separate hospitals where the corpse of John Kennedy would have been. Best Evidence, of course, means the corpse of the body, that when a person is murdered, the best evidence you have is to examine that corpse. Well, that's good in most murder cases. The only exception, actually, is the President of the United States, because there's so many people around, and that physically to alter the body would be more difficult than changing what the doctor saw with his fountain pen, and there would be extra people surrounding it. And once it's given the chemicals to embalmment and it's buried, I doubt that any President of the United States would ever be exhumed for any reason at all. So therefore, I don't see a reason to chop up a body when you're not going to see it later. But I took the book and I took every single allegation he made. I have those all here in a three-hole notebook to show the work I did. I took the hypothesis that Kennedy's body was altered to protect assassins on the grassy knoll to make it appear that Oswald shot John Kennedy from the back of the head. When the article was completed, I mailed it to We. I got a telephone call from the editor. I have his name. He said, "We like your review. It's well done. We'll pay you the $750, which we did, but we can't print it because we expected you would approve of the book, of the findings, and we didn't think you would be critical of the evidence." He said, "We wanted, or we had to have, a book review that was positive, and Best Evidence went on to be a bestseller." Well, why couldn't I do that kind of a review? They didn't tell me what they expected. And the answer is that even though I'm close to David Lifton, or was, my reputation as being a researcher, or I like to think of as probably the best, on the John Kennedy assassination had to be based on critical analysis of Lifton's evidence. I have to be as careful reading any book criticizing the Kennedy assassination material as I am of the original Warren Commission. Just because a book is written about the assassination doesn't mean that that context or that material is more demanding or more positive or more proof than the Warren Commission. Now, my opinions are not for sale. If I get things published, you get better known and you get more articles. I don't publish a lot because I don't write what they want me to. I don't have a book, but I couldn't go out and say, buy it. It was great. And then if you said to me, well, what did I get out of it? I would ask you, I ask anyone who's read it, tell me what you do get out of it. The Bethesda autopsy conclusions were always questioned by researchers with good reason. Dr. Hume did the autopsy, and then he burned his original notes. And history, as I say, is made with a fountain pen, not necessarily a knife. Now, in Dallas, Texas, the evening of the assassination of John Kennedy, the chief of police, Henry Wade, said Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin. We don't have the evidence, but he did it. On the airplane coming back from Dallas to Washington, Lyndon Johnson was told by way of the radio control and J. Edgar Hoover, Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone. Those were the instructions, so there wasn't any reason for I think, to hack up the body of John Kennedy, and there wasn't any evidence in Lifton's book of how they would do it. So in a society where we never learn to be critical or to evaluate evidence, you have to stick with that evidence, and my feeling is that I couldn't conclude that this was a study that told me exactly what happened. Now, just a few paragraphs from the review or book review that wasn't printed, and I'll make that available to you for listeners who want it. I'll make copies of it, retype it for you, and give you copies of the one I did for We that they didn't publish. I said, I don't agree with Lifton's necessity to prove they had to go through all the trouble he describes. One of the most disturbing aspects of Best Evidence is his attempt to throw in endless details of what happened to John Kennedy's corpse and his brains, while at the same time finding it necessary to absolve any human beings for the responsibility of the forgeries. In chapter 28, called the Clandestine Intermission Hypothesis, he has diagrams of the Bethesda Morgue. If there were double autopsies for the sole purpose of chicanery, the common denominator between the two performances had to be Commander James J. Humes and Dr. Boswell, Chief of Pathology at Bethesda. Yet, David Lifton found it necessary to write, in quotes, "It is my personal belief that none of the three autopsy surgeons or other autopsy personnel was involved in a plot to murder the president, nor was any of them involved in a plot to alter the body," end quote. Now, we know none of them were in Dallas when Kennedy was killed, but who does David Lifton believe was altering the body? Why bother to write the book in the first place if those responsible for his outrageous charges didn't have any knowledge of his claims? That would lead us to the inevitable invisible bodies, and there just isn't time in this book for them. Now, I also mentioned in this review the Nuremberg conclusion. David Lifton tried to excuse the Warren Commission from any hocus pocus. After that, he absolved the surgeons and the autopsy personnel of trickery. What was left to wrap this heavy thesis together? Out of the hat, he pulled the old but new Nuremberg defense. As a finale, he wrote in his conclusion of the book, "It is entirely possible that any number of people who thought they were acting honorably and in the line of duty is not disclosing that the body was altered." Is this what the publisher referred to as the gifted detective? acting as high priest over the autopsy hoax? Can government participation in a crime of conspiracy, because covering up is still a conspiracy, a serious offense, be rationalized by Lifton as being in the line of duty, even if they did it? When all of Lifton's findings and conclusions can be explained in a manner identical to Nazi war crimes at Nuremberg, this is tricky and dangerous. We deserve better answers to what happened in Dallas, November 22, 1963, and I don't want to hear them rationalize as line of duty again. Now, in his acknowledgments for helping write the book, he lists quite a few people. One of them is Robert Ramftel, R-A-N-F-T-E-L, who spent many hours in the FBI reading room helping him put this together. Ramftel has just been assigned or employed as a first full-time employee for Bernard Fensterwald's committee to set up archives on the political assassinations in Washington. Bernard Fensterwald was the attorney for James McCord. He's the attorney for Marianne Paisley. He has been an attorney for the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington for many years and eight clients of the Central Intelligence Agency. No one was more important to Watergate than James McCord, and Robert Ramftel has now been hired full-time to James McCord. He also credits various people here. Robert Blair Kaiser, who wrote the book RFK Must Die, the book that Sirhan says he didn't write, and he obviously was hypnotized. He doesn't even remember it, but that was the title of the book that went out. He credits Robert Sam Anson. I have a lot I could say on him. I won't. George O'Toole and Bernard Fensterwald for helping him. Those three I named in a letter in 1967 accusing Mark Lane of covering up the Nazi connection to the assassination and also citing Anson and O'Toole and Fensterwald for deliberately covering up the Nazi connection to the assassination of John Kennedy. He credits Jones Harris. Jones Harris is the son of Ruth Gordon, who was determined to find out who killed John Kennedy. He was a close associate of J. Edgar Hoover, not Herbert Hoover. And when he got closer to the truth that it was more away from the Oswald and into an espionage of a higher level, then he stopped his research and nobody heard from Jones Harris again. And, of course, he credits Harold Weisberg, who acknowledges as his research investigative work going back to the OSS and then working for the federal government, writing books and on the assassinations. Good books, but that's his background, and it stops at a certain point. And Mary Farrell in Texas, he has a who's who here of people he credits for helping him. And it's interesting that after completing the whole book and seeing the credits, the position that those people have taken as against my working on Lee Harvey Oswald and Marina Oswald with the Zeiger family from Argentine at the Minsk Radio Factory and the Young Americans for Freedom and Robert Morris and the Munich gentleman that came right under the wing of Edwin Walker to Dallas, Texas for the assassination and to take over Young Americans for Freedom and the various Nazi connections that were involved with Clay Shaw and Reinhard Galen. I've accused all of them through the years of covering up. On the broadcast in 1981, I listed the problems with best evidence in terms of medical x-rays and the use of information after Kennedy's body was buried that they still could have used and didn't use, such as pictures of Kennedy and the x-rays that were kept from various members doing the investigation that would show where the directions of the bullets went. The jacket of John Kennedy that was taken away so people only could see the drawings, couldn't see the bullet trajectory through the fabric, never tested for that. The Time magazine altering of the photos and the rifle scope. The Zapruder films were rearranged by Life magazine and the Warren Commission. The bullet fragments that weighed more than the deposits in the body of John Connolly were greater than what was in the pristine bullet. The tape recordings that were destroyed when Oswald was alive, taken to the police department. The allowing Ruby to talk and working for Richard Nixon and the House on American Activities years ago, an informer who was used to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. There were a lot of areas that combined would be just as good evidence as the body of John Kennedy to find out what happened. And I think it's very weak to think that you can have a body taken at the time of the assassination out of Parkland Hospital and then be altered in some way. Now, I asked the question, what's wrong with the Lifton thesis? One, the location of the altering of the body, which he says happened. There's nowhere in the book that he confirms whether it was on Air Force One, he suggests. It was at Walter Reed Hospital, he suggests. It was at Bethesda Hospital. He can't define or locate any one of those three places, and it would be really hard to juggle that body around or John Kennedy at that time with so many people watching at the Secret Service, the FBI, the medical staff, Jacqueline Onassis. Was she hovering over an empty coffin while they were shooting it from the back of the head inside the airplane till it landed? None of that is really explained. Then the identification of the doctors with authority to alter the body is missing. All suspected medical staff are cleared, as I mentioned before, and he said he can't find one person. If the main doctors who did the autopsy weren't covering up, he can't come to anyone or name a single person. Another point I made and noticed in the book was the Secret Service was the only government agent named. It excludes any participation of the FBI, of the Defense Intelligence Agency, of the CIA, of the Defense Industry Security Command, of the National Security Agency, and this was a military operation, a military coup in this country, and only the Secret Service was responsible, and they don't have many doctors to do what he said happened. And the fourth point I had made was that there's no necessity, as I said before, to alter that body of John Kennedy. Dr. Hume did an autopsy report. He calls Parkland Hospital. He gets calls from Washington and from the Capitol. He's in Washington at Bethesda, right nearby. And then he destroys his first papers and rewrites it. All you have to do is write the report the way you're told it's going to be, such as the Joseph Mengele conclusions. You don't have to have any physical evidence. They didn't have with Mengele. And they came to conclusions that I'll be detailing in a few weeks. And the next point is that the plot, if there was a plot to rearrange the body to protect the people at Dealey Plaza that were shooting by the fence, there also was a plot to get rid of Lee Harvey Oswald and have him killed by Jack Ruby. Now, the Kennedy murder is over on Friday. Oswald will be killed on Saturday. So what is the need? Where is the need to go to the trouble of cutting up the body of John Kennedy when this thing is going to be opened and closed by Sunday night? The primary person for whom the body is being altered is going to be dead, but he would have to be part of the plot. Getting rid of him would be part of the plot, and I just don't believe that they would go to so much trouble with so much evidence altered and hidden and rearranged that they'd have to chop up the physical remains of the President of the United States. I've attended autopsies when my first husband was working for a hematology department at Cedars-Sinai and L.A. County Hospital. And once you drain that body and cut it open, you can't do two autopsies on one body. No way any doctor or person will tell you that. And you couldn't put him into one room and do an early morning autopsy and then put him into another room and start all over with observers. That skull is already cut. The body's cut open. And there's no way that you could do two in one morning on John Kennedy. Another point is that David Lifton had some emotional or psychological necessity to prove to the Warren Commission that you did a good job, but somebody else was remiss, and he bent over backwards, and I don't want to discuss, and I'm not sure, of his relationship with Mr. Liebler, who was teaching law, Wesley Liebler of the Warren Commission, who he was close friends with at UCLA, and what forced him to make his decisions. So I worked on the physical evidence. I read all about the autopsies, the chase of the vans, carrying them around, the ambulances, and so forth, and switching bodies and men in black in an outside room of the hospital. It sounded more like a rat race at a space station. And believe me, I didn't pass off Roger. In two words, I didn't pass the book lightly. I probably have spent more time on best evidence than any other single person in the United States, and I did it right. And when I did it right, I couldn't find the conclusions match the evidence that he went to great lengths to illustrate. And therefore, I had to say this book has no meaning in terms of research of what happened at Dealey Plaza or to the assassination of John Kennedy. We'll take a one-minute break now and then get on to other matters. I didn't mean to spend 1.5 hour almost on this subject, but it's very, very important to get it clear that not every book written on the Kennedy assassination is going to help you understand one tiny part of the assassination, not necessarily. You have to be analytical at all times, no matter who writes it, even if I write it or say it. You have to ask for the sources and be analytical and figure things out for yourself. Well, as I said, we'll take a 1-minute break and then come back to some other news.